You are tuned to the Nighttime Podcast, focusing on the fringe of Atlantic Canada. Mysteries, crime, the paranormal, and the weird. All under the soft glow of the moon. Welcome. Now, here is your host, Jordan Boneparty.
In all corners of our country, if you ask around, you'll hear stories of ghosts or monsters that at some time in the area's history briefly made themselves known and wreaked havoc on a family or the citizens as a whole. This episode will describe a community crippled with fear and overcome by a feeling of defenselessness. A community whose most vulnerable were preyed upon by a beast too frightening to be dreamt up. Like many great villains from the pages of horror literature, by day this monster dwelled in the darkness of the forest that surrounded the village, and only entered civilization under the cover of the night's darkness to commit its crimes. This isn't a work of fiction, however, and the community knew exactly who the monster was. In fact, he was one of them. Tonight's story will be the first in a series focusing on the life and the crimes of Alan Legere. Alan Legere is an infamous Canadian serial killer who, after escaping from prison on a murder conviction, stalked his community, committing several additional murders while hiding in the dense forest surrounding the region. During this episode, I'll provide a timeline of Alan Legere's life, starting with his birth and ending just after his first murder conviction. Throughout the series, I'll be joined by highly respected journalist and author Rick McLean, who was one of the leading team covering the news as it broke, and was a first-hand witness to many of the events I'll discuss. Let's now begin Alan Legere, The Monster of the Miramichi, Part 1. On the eastern tip of New Brunswick, Canada, lies a picturesque region named the Miramichi River Valley. Extending from the Miramichi Bay and traveling inland for nearly 300 kilometers along the winding path of the majestic river where it gets its name, the Miramichi River Valley contains a collection of small towns and villages that over time were carved into the densely forested area. Miramichi's history dates back thousands of years as a logging and fishing area used by the native Mi'kmaq tribe, and still to this day, its roughly 50,000 residents still rely heavily on the valley's bountiful fishing and logging resources. With the people well aware of the darkness of the forest, living in an area predating the formation of Canada roughly 10 times over, the Miramichi River Valley must certainly have its share of ghost stories and legends of monsters passed down through the generations. These stories of demons from history and vague apparitions would be seldom mentioned nowadays, as the Miramichi River Valley had the unfortunate experience of meeting face to face with a real monster. One whose existence isn't speculation or folklore, his is undeniable. In fact, many of them had already known all about him. Alan Legere was born on a Friday the 13th in 1948, weighing 13 pounds. Alan was so proud of his connection with the unlucky number 13 that when he met people, it was often one of the first things about himself he shared. From the very beginning, Alan was disadvantaged. All that's known about Alan's father is that he was a violent alcoholic his mother briefly dated, resulting in Alan being born to a single mother of four, living in a rundown home, within one of the poorest areas in the region. Life was certainly an uphill battle for young Alan Legere. In his youth, Alan was described as a handsome young boy with striking pale blue eyes and thick dark hair. Most accounts tell of him being well-mannered, polite, and intelligent, but with a tendency to be mischievous. Not mischievous to a great extent, just typical boy stuff like throwing rocks and horseplay. When tracing back to the start of his life of problems, an incident that occurred when Alan was just 8 years old is considered by many as being character-defining. His older brother Freddie, a soldier who his mother Louise was infinitely proud of, was walking across the bridge seen in the cover art of this episode, the well-known Morrissey Bridge in Miramichi. It was early evening, just after sundown, when a car crossing the bridge hit him and the three friends he was with from behind, killing Freddie Legere and one of the others. The Legere family believed that the driver of the vehicle that killed Freddie was being protected, and due to the Legere's poor financial status, they lacked the ability to seek justice. This is believed to have resulted in Alan's lifelong distrust with any authority figure. After what was certainly a traumatic event for Alan and his family, he was said to have become less social, and the first signs of his now-famous violent temper began to show. It was just about at age 10 that Alan would start his transformation from the sweet blue-eyed boy into an intimidating young man. The change was sped up in part by his passion, bordering on an obsession with weightlifting and bodybuilding. By junior high school, Alan habitually followed a rigorous exercise routine, one he developed completely on his own and constantly modified. As his physique improved, his academic performance deteriorated. The blue-eyed schoolboy was now almost completely gone, and by age 16, Alan Legere was now known for his thick arms and puffed-out chest, and at this point he dropped out of school, never to return. With his newly acquired free time, Alan began gaining the experience that would serve him well during his life of crime. Not long after he dropped out of school, he became interested in breaking into homes. He often spoke and bragged about it to his friends, including bragging about touching the female occupants of the homes as they slept. As talented as he believed himself to be, he was charged with theft at age 16, served 15 days for it in a youth detention center, and charged again at 18, receiving a 6-month sentence. In his early 20s, there were moments when things seemed to be improving for Alan. During this time, he met a woman and the two were quickly married. Legere even found steady work employed as a machinist, but it wouldn't be long before he would return to his blossoming life of crime. Now, Alan, entering his mid-20s, was becoming increasingly bolder and was much more unpredictable. Still maintaining a strict workout regime, he now cultivated an interest in Satanism and demonology and had become obsessive about cleanliness. Not the kind of obsession on cleanliness that had him washing his hands often. Alan wanted every muscle he focused on in his workouts to be finely polished, a task he attempted by taking multiple, often over 1 hour long showers every day. The obsession with his body even found its way into a police report when Alan was arrested after a high-speed chase. When police approached him, a distraught Alan Legere shouted, "Don't touch my body, please don't touch my body." When the officer subdued and cuffed him, a now calmer Legere asked the officer sincerely, "Don't you think my body is beautiful?" It was during this time Alan Legere began experimenting with hard drugs. With his new interest, Alan became much more volatile and his marriage began to break down. Perhaps drug use was behind an unusual incident that occurred when Alan entered a local church during a packed Sunday mass wearing nothing more than cut-off jean shorts. Alan addressed the packed church by telling all in attendance that they were going to hell because he was the real Jesus Christ and they were all worshiping a false god. He also gave an impromptu history on Lucifer and Christ's relationship to the stunned onlookers. As Alan's drug use further escalated, his mental state further deteriorated, and it quickly became too much for his wife, who divorced him and left the province without looking back. His wife leaving had the same effect as when he left school years prior. With his newfound free time, Legere was able to explore his dark side with little interruption. At 26 years old, Alan was gaining a reputation now for extreme violent behavior. In one incident, he got in a fight with a coworker while working on a dockyard. During the fight, Alan had knocked the other man down and then quickly grabbed a long pole with a hook on the end and charged for the man. Three other men at the scene had to disarm Legere, preventing him certainly from taking the man's life. After leaving the dockyard job, Legere began employment at the Chatham Zodiac nightclub, a notoriously rough dive bar known for fights and shootings on the premises. During his time working at the Zodiac Club, Alan became a suspect in two bizarre police investigations. The first was the murder of a local woman who was stabbed over 70 times and left for dead on her doorstep. The second was a case where a corpse was dug up from a local cemetery and its head was sawed off. The head was then left on the doorstep of a man who coincidentally had wronged Legere in some insignificant way in the days prior. Despite being interrogated in both cases, he was never charged in either, and both remain to this day to be unsolved. As the slow escalation of violence continued, a string of crimes against women would result in the loss of his job at the nightclub and would provide him another stint behind bars. Two of these crimes were very similar. There was two separate occasions Legere reacted violently to women refusing to dance with him at the club. In one case, he simply spit in the woman's face. And on the second, he grabbed her by the crotch and whispered into her ear, you'll dance when I say to dance. And the final event, and the event that would result in the jail sentence, was when he approached a female DJ at the Zodiac, and he kissed her. When she resisted, he attempted to tear her shirt and bra off. This crime resulted in the loss of his job, and again, it led to a 30-day jail sentence. Now, Legere in his early 30s, the many brief prison terms seemingly had no effect on his accelerating violent and antisocial tendencies. In fact, the string of crimes he would commit during this period of his life made it crystal clear how dangerous of a man Legere actually is. During my telephone conversation with journalist Rick McLean, he had the following to say about Alan Legere during this point in his life.
He had a reputation for being volatile. There were stories that had been told for years of people that he knew that would wake up and he'd be standing at the foot of their bed looking at them. He called it creepy crawling, and he would creepy crawl into someone's house just to show that he could get in even though the doors were locked, and then he would just stand there and look at them until they woke up. So he had a reputation of being a very strange individual, bright, you know, not a genius, but bright. People who had known him in school said he had the potential to be a good student, but he just was unable to focus on it. By this time, he was large. He'd been picked on when he was younger, including by my father and his brothers, apparently. And he started working out in weights when he was very young. So he's only about 5'11", but he was barrel-chested, big arms. And, you know, someone who saw him fight said he fought a lot like a cat, scratching, clawing, biting, rolling around in the ground. It was strictly no holds barred if he was going to get into a scrap with you.
Upon returning home from his incarceration due to the sexual assault of the DJ at the Zodiac nightclub, Alan would be involved in two separate bar fights that ended in extreme violence, the second of which sent him back to prison for what would up to this point be his longest stay. In the first incident, while drinking heavily at a local nightclub, Alan and another man got into a physical altercation. During the fight, Alan smashed a beer bottle and stabbed the jagged glass into the face of his opponent, resulting in serious injuries. In the second, Alan picked another man's beer up off the table and took a drink. When the man grabbed it out of Alan's hand, Alan picked up a bottle, smashed it, and charged towards the man. As Legere charged towards the man, an off-duty police officer playing pool nearby swung his pool cue, hitting Legere in the face and fracturing his jaw. It wasn't the altercation at the bar that got Legere sent back to the prison. It, in fact, was his behavior at the police station immediately after his arrest. As a testament to how unpredictable Legere could be, while he was being booked at the Chatham police station, he was said to be friendly and conversational with the officers. In fact, he was almost jovial until, without warning, Alan pulled out a concealed knife and held it to the throat of the booking officer. Despite the dramatic scene, he was quickly restrained and no injuries were sustained by this officer. Legere faced and was convicted of concealed weapon charges in connection with the incident at the police station. And although it would result in a serious prison term, this gave Alan the opportunity to prove he wasn't a mindless thug and was in fact a very persuasive speaker. During his appeal, after his conviction, Alan prepared and delivered an impactful 45-minute speech to a packed courtroom that outlined how he believed the system had failed him. The judge was so moved by Legere's speech, he surprisingly reduced the sentence down to a 2-year term, much less than anyone was anticipating. When the prison term ended, Alan, now 34 years old, would again create the illusion that things were improving. He vowed to make a fresh start and not fall back into the bad habits that had him in and out of custody for the better part of his life. His first step towards stabilizing his life was to marry his new girlfriend, Donna. The newly married Legeres decided to move to Moncton, New Brunswick, feeling they'd have a better chance at employment and a better chance to stay on the right side of the law by keeping plenty of distance between Alan and the Miramichi area. Unsurprisingly, Miramichi was not the problem. Shortly after the Legeres settled into their new home in Moncton, the police were flooded with reports of burglaries throughout the city. It was immediately apparent a highly skilled thief was working the area, and the thief was cocky about it. On several occasions, victims reported their bed sheets being pulled off and their underwear being removed while they slept. Although he managed to get away with it for the majority of the summer, a police dog caught his scent and led the authorities to the trailer Legere shared with his new wife Donna. With Alan in the trailer, surrounded by police, he made a daring escape attempt by jumping out the rear window, making a dash for it. During the commotion, a police officer shot Allen in the back, and the Moncton cat burglar was caught. After another failed attempt at living amongst society, Legere was now back in the court system, facing charges related to the many burglaries he committed during this summer. The key witness against him was a man and wife who'd had awoken to find Allen in their home. They identified him in the courtroom and stated they were certain it was him because they could never forget his pale blue eyes. Much like his last trial, Allen stole the show again. During this time, it wasn't with an impressive speech. For this spectacle, during the court proceedings, Allen pulled out a razor he'd concealed in the waistband of his pants, and he shouted, "This is what I think of this," and slashed both of his wrists, covering himself in his own blood. Unlike his favor-winning speech at the prior court appearance, this display only resulted in shrieks from the jury and led to several people in attendance running out of the courtroom in a state of shock. The suicide attempt turned out to be just as effective as Legere's defense against the charges. Allen, with his wrists in bandages, was found guilty of the burglary charges and now received a 3-year sentence, a good amount of which he'd end up spending in solitary confinement as punishment for fighting and for being involved in the prison's drug trade. With another prison term behind him, Allen Legere, now 38 years old, would return to New Brunswick for what now, in hindsight, will have been his last opportunity at ending his life of crime and becoming a contributing member of society. Tragically, in just a matter of months, Allen would commit a series of crimes that would leave the entire Miramichi River Valley gripped by fear and would earn him his moniker, the Monster of the Miramichi. Upon release from his 3-year prison term, Allen would return to his prior home in Moncton, only to find out that his wife Donna was not anxiously awaiting his return. In fact, she had sold his car and the mobile home they shared and fled the area prior to his return. Undoubtedly, she did this to avoid continuation of the physical abuse he inflicted on her before his conviction. And with Donna out of the picture, there was nothing left to tie him to the Moncton area, so an angry and desperate Allen Legere would be left with little choice but to return to the Miramichi area. At this point in Allen Legere's life, we end up at a turning point. With the first act of his horrifying story behind us, we've witnessed the gradual transition, starting with a cute, well-mannered boy born to unfortunate circumstances, through his time as a hell-raising young man obsessed with bodybuilding and the devil, and then even further into his time as a grown man who spent the bulk of his life bouncing in and out of jail. We will now enter the second act of this story, with Allen Legere returning to Miramichi from Moncton as a scorned 38-year-old man with absolutely nothing to lose. He's now positioned to complete his transition into his final form as the Monster of the Miramichi. Upon returning to his original hometown, Legere began plans to organize a crime that would provide him one big final score, but when all is said and done, he would be forever known as the ringleader of one of the most brutal and violent crimes to occur in the history of New Brunswick. It would start just after 10 p.m. on a Saturday evening. John and Mary Glendenning had just finished closing down the general store they had owned and operated for over 30 years in rural Black River Bridge. After restocking shelves and tidying up after another busy day, the couple, both in their 60s, returned to their home, which sits on the same lot of land as the store. Following their typical evening routine, upon arriving home, John Glendenning took a seat in the living room and turned on the evening news, as Mary was in the adjacent kitchen preparing tea. It seemed like any other Saturday night, until a violent crash coming from the front door would break the silence. When Mary and John looked to the door, which was now left hanging by a hinge, they saw three men. Two of them were noticeably smaller than the third, and the two smaller ones had their faces concealed, one by a nylon stocking, and the other one with a cap pulled low. One of these men brandished a baseball bat, while the other had a large rock in his hand. The third man, older and heavier, was Allen Legere. Immediately upon entering, Legere hung back by the door as one of the younger and smaller accomplices would charge at and bludgeon John Glendenning with the large rock, a rock which he brought into the home from one of the many gardens Mary Glendenning maintained on the property. As John collapsed to his knees, he pleaded with the attackers that he'd cooperate and give them whatever they wanted. The other young man at this point grabbed Mary and dragged her back into the kitchen where he tied her to a chair. As Mary sat in the chair, she heard the man who tied her pulling the kitchen phone into the wall. She immediately realized they weren't simply going to stop at burglarizing the home. With very little effort, she managed to untie herself, and she instinctually made her way back into the living room to check on the health of her husband. As she arrived, she found the man beating John, demanding he tell them where the couple hid their safe and what the combination was. Due to the injuries John sustained, the 66-year-old man was having a difficult time speaking. To ensure his cooperation, the men threatened to rape Miss Glendenning if he didn't cooperate. One of the men grabbed Mary and removed her underwear and sexually assaulted her using both his hands and the blunt weapon he carried in front of John. Seeing that her husband was unable to communicate, Miss Glendenning pleaded with the men to allow her to show them the safe and open it. Mary was then escorted up the stairs to her bedroom where the Glendennings kept the safe by one of the younger men in addition to Alan Legere. When she reached the safe, she put her hand to the dial and started to enter the combination when she was struck violently in the back of her head repeatedly until she fell unconscious. When Miss Glendenning finally came to, she found herself on the floor in the upstairs bathroom. Despite her life-threatening injuries, she managed to make her way to a telephone and dial 911. Although she was having difficulty speaking, she was able to provide enough information to the operator to explain that she was robbed, raped, beaten, and she believed she was going to die soon. When help arrived, it would come in the form of Mary Glendenning's daughter, her son-in-law, and a swarm of police cars. As they entered the front door of the home, they found the entire place ransacked, with blood on the floors, walls, and even blood on the ceiling. As they searched the house, they found Mary first. She was still gripping the telephone in an upstairs bedroom. With injuries so disfiguring, her daughter wasn't even immediately sure it was her. When John was found, he was slumped behind the door of another upstairs bedroom. He was deceased, and his hands were tied behind his back with an alarm clock's cord, and he had a shirt tightly tied around his neck. Although the cause of death was found to be suffocation from the shirt, John's beating was more than most could survive. His neck, cheek, and jaw were broken, and he had deep cuts covering his body. It would only take 2 days before the 38-year-old Alan Legere and his two teenage accomplices would be arrested on murder charges. Despite the younger pair and Legere pointing the blame at each other initially, the teenagers would avoid a lengthy trial by pleading guilty. Legere, however, would opt to take his chances with a jury trial, insisting then, as he does today, that he wasn't in the home that night. To describe the arrests, the trial, and walk us through the events that lead us into the third act, which we'll hear in the second part of the series, I will play an excerpt from a telephone call I had with someone who lived through every moment of this case. Rick McLean is a highly respected journalist who, during Legere's killing spree, was the editor of the local newspaper, the Miramichi Leader. Mr. McLean agreed to share with me his firsthand account of many of the key moments, and going forward in the second part of the series, whenever possible, I'll use his words to describe the events. So let us now hear from Rick.
I remember that the Glendenning one happened. It was late in June. This was 1986. I've been the editor for a couple of years. I think this was the first murder that I was responsible for leading a news team on. We had four reporters, staff photographer, and a second editor. So we were a pretty good news team for a twice-weekly newspaper. And we found out pretty quickly what the gist of it was. The police weren't saying much, and the first report that we had wasn't overly detailed. Our reporter was young and didn't really know exactly what was going on. Fairly quickly, we got the idea, the word leaked out at the small community, that there were a couple of teenagers who were apparently involved, but the gang leader, the leader of the three, was very well known to, well, everybody in the community, Alan Legere. So then it became a case of sort of sticking with the police while they were hunting around for these people. And it didn't take much, didn't take very long. Legere was rounded up fairly quickly. He was still in the community. And the two teenagers, I think, had fled to Ontario, and they surrendered themselves a few days later. So it really sort of all happened and was resolved in terms of arrests very, very quickly. Well, it was interesting what happened in this one. And originally, because Legere was caught quickly, the teenagers were caught quickly, we didn't have sort of a level of panic. That was going to come much later. Because in the Glendenning case, we started to hear something about the violence. We knew that there was a robbery involved. There were reports that the police had found a safe. But a lot of the details didn't come out until the trial. Now, the trial was an absolute sensation. Alan Legere was famous. I suppose infamous is probably the better word. He was known. He had a history of violence, came from a very rough part of town. In fact, my father grew up basically just down the street from him. My father was the oldest of seven brothers, and he said they remember beating up on Alan Legere regularly because he was a mouthy little cocky guy. It was really only when it got to trial. Now, we understood going into the trial this was going to be a very big deal. The actual courtroom was very small. It was sort of two stories high with a balcony on the second floor and red carpet, and it's all wood. It was over 100 years old, so it was built as if it was something from a Shakespearean theater. And then you had these two teenagers who were well known for being sort of local thugs and members of families with a history of being involved in sort of B&Es and stealing stuff. And then Alan Legere, Alan Legere's name was like the boogeyman in Miramichi long before he was arrested for the Glendenning murder. Here, the two teenagers pleaded guilty the first week. So then everyone's wondering if Legere is going to plead guilty, but of course he doesn't, which means that the three-week trial has to go ahead, which means that the lone survivor, John Glendenning's wife, Mary, who was the victim of a ferocious attack, sexual assault, left for dead, we end up, as a result of this testimony, we hear the 911 operator. She testifies. We hear the telephone call. We hear the 911 operator sort of talking to Mary, trying to calm her, telling her, you know, I'm going to stay with you. It's going to be all right. The police are on their way. Staying with her right up to the moment when the police officer came on the phone and said, we're here. We've got it now. Mary testifying. And then the most remarkable part of all would be that Legere decided to testify. Now, there's no requirement for a person accused of crime to testify. You have a legal right not to. And his lawyer, Pete Mockler, had urged him. In fact, people who were in the courtroom said they could hear them in the next room shouting. Mockler didn't want him to go on the stand. But Legere was determined to. I think, you know, Legere was obviously a sociopath. And he had spent his whole life lying to people and convincing them of things that weren't true. So I think he thought he could do this on the stand. I was there that day when he came out and testified. I sat next to our reporter and watched as he took the stand. And the first words out of his mouth were, I wasn't even there. As soon as he said that, I swung my head to the right and I looked at the jury. And I turned to our reporter and went, he lost them. They don't believe that. And Mockler did his best with him. And then the prosecutor, he's now a judge, but back then was a prosecutor, Fred Ferguson, got up. And really, by the time he was done with him, he had demolished Legere's credibility. So the jury came back the next day, and they convicted him in no time flat. And so really, for us, the case was over. It was sensational. It was 3 weeks of remarkable story of day and nights for us as a newsroom. But then he was gone, out of sight, out of mind, in a maximum security prison, exactly where he belonged. But the maximum security prison was in Renews, which is a short drive from where the courthouse is. It's, you know, 30, 40 kilometers away. And what happened was Legere had been clearly plotting all along that he was going to get back out. The first reports I was hearing from guards I knew of was that Legere had gone squirrely on the inside. He basically turned into a caveman. His hair was long. His room was disgusting. And then at some point, I think he figured it out and he cleaned up. He stopped being a problem. He became a model prisoner. Well, what he was doing was he was plotting. He was trying to get into a position where the guards would see him as a no-muss, no-fuss inmate they wouldn't have to worry about. What he was also doing was he was arranging, apparently he poured urine in his ear or something and got an ear infection. And, you know, he was arrested in 86. He was convicted in 87. Finally, by 89, they're going to take him to a medical specialist for his ear in Moncton, a place where he used to live. And this is what he'd been planning for. He had the guards lulled into a sense of security. He was going to a hospital that he knew in a city that he knew. And when he got there, what they didn't know was he had inserted the television antenna from his TV up his rectum, and he had made a makeshift key. He was carrying a coat with him, and they didn't know that he had, in essence, unlocked his handcuffs on the drive, the 150-kilometer drive to Moncton. He said, look, I have to go to the bathroom. They let him go. They weren't supposed to let him go alone. He was basically went into the bathroom, threw off the handcuffs, and burst out the door of the hospital bathroom, waving what they thought was a knife, it was the TV antenna, and shot past them. Now, guards in this situation are allowed to have guns with them because of the concern that an inmate might get his hand on a gun. So all they had was pepper spray. Well, pepper spray's no good when you're spraying the back of a guy's head when he's running away from you. He burst past them. He was out the door. He went running into the parking lot. There was a woman there. I think she had a bird in a cage or something in her car. And he kidnapped her, the bird, and the car, forced her out of the car shortly thereafter, fled to a section of Moncton he knew, dumped the car, and vanished into the woods. And we heard a lot of that in real time because we were in the newsroom and the phone rang and our reporter who had covered him in court, it was her husband who had a police scanner. And I remember, I'll never forget, her face turned white and she turned to me in the newsroom and she said, Legere has escaped in Moncton. And she said, my husband's on the line listening to the scanner. And I told her, I said, tell him to put his phone next to the scanner. And I punched the button in the newsroom so that everything from his telephone was going over the paging system so the entire building could hear it, and everybody stopped moving. Because we all knew, we were confident of one thing, he was coming back. We were absolutely sure that he had no intention of running away. He was coming back.
We will conclude this episode with Alan Legere now having escaped from custody after his first murder conviction and fleeing into the darkness of the dense forest that surrounds the Miramichi River Valley. In part two of this series, which we'll hear in the coming weeks, we will pick up from this point and learn about all the other murders Alan would commit, all the while casting a blanket of fear over the people of Miramichi. That will conclude tonight's episode of the Nighttime Podcast. A huge thank you to Brandon Boone for contributing the music you heard in this episode. You may know him from his work on the No Sleep Podcast. If you're as taken by his music as I am, you can hear more of his incredible compositions at wondroussound.com. That's wondroussound.com. I would also like to thank my podcast partners at Dark Myths. We at Dark Myths are a collective made up of like-minded podcasters hell-bent on bringing you something interesting to listen to for every day of the week. To browse our members, please visit darkmyths.org. For a personal recommendation, try Pete's Paranormal Chronicles, a wonderfully strange comedic fiction show about a paranormal investigator working in my home province of Nova Scotia. If you listen carefully, you may even hear my voice. If you're interested in hearing more content from the Nighttime Podcast and getting the background dirt on the episodes, you may be interested in my Patreon campaign, where for $1 a month, you'll have access to a monthly bonus episode that looks back at the prior month's releases. That being said, on behalf of myself and the show's listeners, I'd like to thank the continued support of the show's patron supporters and welcome the newest members of the group, Thomas, Jesse, Cedric, Shelley, and Alicia. In addition to providing me great pride and motivation, your generous donations make this show possible. I would like to thank you for listening to the Nighttime Podcast. If you enjoy your time here, please rate, review, and subscribe to the show on iTunes. I also invite you to join the listener community at facebook.com/nighttimepodcast. If you have any story ideas or feedback on the show, I'd love to hear from you at nighttimepodcast@gmail.com or on Twitter @NighttimePod. I look forward to talking to you again soon.